this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Dr. Paul Venturelli about some of the data he has collected using fishing apps, as well as some data he collected at a past conference. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Venturelli. Paul earned his bachelor's degree from York University, a master's degree from the University of Alberta, and a PhD from the University of Toronto. He completed a postdoc position at Louisiana State University before becoming an assistant and then associate professor in the Department of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology at the University of Minnesota. Paul is currently an assistant professor of fisheries science in the Department of Biology and the director of the Environmental Sciences PhD program at Ball State University. Paul and his lab study fish life history, temperature effects, and population dynamics in mostly recreational fisheries, while also exploring digital sources of fisheries data, including angler apps. Welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Thanks, Nick. I'm excited to be on. This is actually my first time on a podcast.
All right, so I've talked to a few different researchers while doing this podcast, and they've covered life history and population dynamics, but I think you might be the first interested in digital sources of information available in angler apps. What got you interested in that particular area?
It started almost 10 years ago now, an undergrad in my class, and he wanted to work with me to convince the DNR to develop an app for holding virtual tournaments. And we tried, but the idea really didn't have legs, but I realized how many apps are out there. And that got me wondering if they're collecting useful data, the apps. And not just apps, we've kind of broadened to online search data, online fora, social media, maybe even podcasts, I don't know.
As you mentioned, there's already a variety of apps out there, and not all collect the same data. And yourself and some co-authors explored some of these apps or websites or forum. What kind of information is available in these different platforms that would be of interest to researchers or fisheries managers?
There's a lot. So if you're just thinking in terms of apps, we kind of break it down into three categories. There's data that describe the catches. So what species is being caught, the size of the fish, the fate if it was kept or released, and then associated condition. That's actually really easy for an app to pull, right? If you have a location and timestamp, it can pull the weather from wherever. Information on trips. So you went fishing, you went on a trip and you caught a bunch of fish, but that trip has a date and timestamp associated with it, and also a location, and then people as well. So information on the people, the users themselves. And these are general demographics. So things like how old the user is, gender, location, etc.
So you have all this information available or being collected by these apps. How would a fisheries management biologist or researcher or someone just interested in the data be able to get it and then use it to inform decisions?
Well, there's a couple of ways to get the data. If you develop your own app as a researcher or an agency, then those data are going to your server. And if you're interested in app data from an app that was developed by a private company, then you need to approach that company and ask for the data. And some of them are willing to share and others are not. It really kind of depends on kind of their philosophy and some of their privacy levels and things like that. And then as far as what we do with the data, that's what we're still trying to figure out. There's a lot of potential, but we have to think about the quality of the data, the type of data. It's also a dynamic space. The apps are changing, user base is changing, so we need to keep tabs on that. So it's still pretty new. A lot of the research right now that's going on is trying to compare them mostly to creel data, because I think that's the most obvious connection. You know, you have a bunch of catches in a location, and if you can estimate effort, and you have the size structure, so it's pretty similar to a creel or an angler diary, a logbook. I think there's all kinds of amazing potential beyond that. You know, the ecology of the fish, to understanding the spread of invasive species and human behavior too. I think there's a lot that we can do. We just have to kind of poke around a little bit and figure it out.
All right, so then what would the ideal app look like for collecting usable data that can be applied to management questions?
That depends on the question. I think a lot of the apps are close-ish to collecting a lot of Creel-type data. But we have a follow-up paper that's on my to-do list that identifies some gaps in the data that are being collected. You know, the biggest ones are anglers not logging all fish. So they'll log a subset. It's often just the memorable ones. Most do not collect effort data. So they'll do they'll log a fish, but we don't know how long it took them to catch that fish, how long they were fishing for. So we don't have trip lengths. Sometimes, or rarely, we will have information on the number of lines as well. So things that we would use to estimate effort. And we really know little about the user. So I mentioned demographics, but a lot of the apps don't collect that information from their users. They don't want to burden their users, and there's privacy concerns too. So the biggest one that we would like to have as far as user information, I think, would be, you know, where the users are coming from to fish. So something like their zip code would be nice.
Is it just as simple as approaching some of these companies and asking if they can add some of these additional questions or components to their existing app, or is it going to take developing a whole another app by a new company?
You can go either route. I think if you have an app that's fairly popular, then you already have a pretty strong user base, and that's a hard thing to establish. So you can go your own way, certainly, especially if there's a smaller fishery, and then you could design the app exactly the way you want it to be, almost like a diary. But if you're working with a company that has a large user base, then that is also very tempting, or there's a huge incentive there to work with them. If they will work with you, they are sensitive to the user experience. That's kind of been my experience, is that, you know, they say, we can do anything. We can collect any information you want, but we can't burden our users. You know, we developed this to be fun. We would like it to contribute to fishery science, but we can't have someone filling out a 10-minute survey every time they catch a fish. That's not fun for them. And so what we're getting a lot of traction with is suggesting ways with, and sometimes they're better at knowing how this works anyway, ways that they can collect data without burdening the user. So an example would be effort. So you can ask a user to turn on and off a timer for when they start fishing and end fishing, but they're probably going to forget. Or you can just track where they are spatially on a map. And if they're on the water and they're moving on the water in a way that is consistent with a fishing trip, you know, versus tubing, then you can estimate effort that way. And it's not going to be perfect, but it would be better than nothing or burdening the user.
One of the apps that I have very, very minimal experience in using in my own personal fishing trips is Fishency. It tracks that effort, but I didn't like it because it drained my battery down too much between streaming different podcasts and music on my phone to keeping the GPS tracking on while I was fishing. It really drained the battery down pretty much. That, and most people just kind of, the novelty of these apps wears out, and they don't have the best compliance over time, is what I would imagine. Is that pretty true, that most anglers, they might use them right away at the beginning, and then after a while they kind of quit?
I think there's certainly a percentage of users that do that. I guarantee there's a percentage of users that do that. Yeah, it has a lot to do with, I think, that user experience, and there's always what they call, you know, retention rates. And retention rates are quite low for any app. So I don't see why a phishing app would be any different. And then it's just up to the company to continue to develop and engage their users and build in content that is attractive to the users and keeps them coming back.
The retention of these apps is kind of like the angler that agrees to do an angler diary and then decides not to, resulting in low compliance. I guess, is that comparable, that anglers agreeing to use this app and not filling it out after a while is similar to someone agreeing to do an angler diary and doing it the first few days and then not logging any other catches in their angler diary?
Yes and no. So if the app is designed to be a diary, especially for research purposes, then that would be the case. I don't see any reason why it'd be any different than a diary. it might be a little better because it might be easier to enter the data online than it is to put them down on paper and then, you know, save that paper, keep it dry, and eventually turn it in. But I think most of the apps aren't designed to be a diary so much as they're designed by private companies to be fun. So like the social aspect of it. And I think that's what keeps people coming back. So when that's the case, you don't really expect compliance in the same way, unless it's a mandatory reporting situation, but that's more common in Europe. We tend not to get that in North America. You know, if you're working with a commercial lab that was developed to be social, then the expectation is that you're generally going to get data that aren't exactly akin to a Creel survey or a diary. It's more what they are interested in sharing, and that tends to be the memorable fish or the strange fish. I log everything because I would love all of the users to do the same. I think it would make our labs a lot easier from a research perspective, and other users do that, but you can see for some it's just the big ones.
All right, and all this interest that you have in Angler apps kind of plays right into a current opening you have for a PhD position in your lab that would be working firsthand with some of these apps. What can you tell us about that opportunity?
Yeah, we just got a project funded, so we need someone starting in January. That's the long and short of it. A PhD student, the project involves Angler apps and citizen science in support of rockfish conservation in coastal British Columbia. The goal of the project is to increase angler compliance rates within marine protected areas along coastal British Columbia, and also the use of descender devices. And this is it's along the entire coast, which is pretty cool because you can do some of this stuff, and it's been done on a fairly local level, but doing this coast-wide is interesting, and it is involving an app. There are other components to the project. There's kind of a field study to look at mortality rates associated with the descender devices, and also if there's any effect on sound production by these rockfish, which there's interest in using that sound production to estimate abundance. But if barotrauma is affecting the ability of these rockfish to make sound, that's going to affect estimates of abundance. So the student will enroll in Ball State's amazing environmental scientist PhD program. And I'm not just saying that because I'm the director. And they're also going to spend 1 or 2 months per summer in the field working in British Columbia, working with the data and likely also helping with the descender field experiment part as well. So I encourage all kinds of people to apply. It's a pretty exciting project.
And if anyone wants to ask you questions about the position or project, I'm sure they can shoot you an email or ask you in person at the upcoming AFS meeting, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'm also going to hit social media, listservs, and job boards too to post this opportunity.
All right, and speaking of conferences, last year I sat in on a pretty interesting talk that you gave regarding some of the factors that affect attendance at presentations. I guess, how did that idea come about?
Oh, you were there. Cool. I've always wondered what affects attendance. So you sit in a room and people come and go. And sometimes you're part of that coming and going as well. And sometimes a lot of people are moving. Sometimes very few people are moving. And I've always wondered what's driving the dynamics. So I stand up to give a talk and the room fills. Sometimes that happens. Is that because there are no other interesting talks or mine is relatively more interesting? Or if the room empties, is it me or is there just a really big name next door? So I've had the idea, but never really had the data or been organized enough to get the data. And then I was sitting in at AFS Portland and I noticed that this volunteer keeps coming into the room and she was doing headcounts. So long story short, I found out why she was doing it. I asked for the data from the people that were, it was actually the conference organizers. Asked for the data, and then our lab developed the paper. And it was a lot of work, but we had a lot of fun doing it.
You kind of laid out a couple of scenarios there, but there are hundreds of presentations to choose from when deciding our individual schedules at conferences. And I usually pick topics that are appealing to my job or what I might be researching at the time, but I'm also a sucker for talks with a catchy title. And I think that's the first thing people attempt when trying to boost attendance at their own talk, so what did your research figure out when people try to catchy title? Or I guess you didn't look at catchy titles, but title length.
Yeah, so yeah, we didn't look at title novelty or the catchiness of it, but it's on our list. We talked about it, but we couldn't really come up with a good way to score novelty. So we did look at title length, and that was interesting. And it was short titles and also long abstracts. And we can't really figure that out, but the short titles might speak to that novelty aspect. We have to take a look to see if short titles tend to be the norm, the more novel ones. So that might be one explanation.
A lot of the factors that I imagine would affect presentation attendance are somewhat out of the hands of the presenter. So how might the day or time or room assignment affect how many people are in attendance?
Yeah, and I think this speaks to the power of the organizers. I think we've all kind of been there, and you kind of hold your breath to see what slot you get, and sometimes you're not happy with the one you get, and other times you are very happy, and yeah, it's kind of out of your hands. So time of day was by far the most important factor, and we actually tweeted, when the paper came out, we tweeted it, and one of the responses from someone was, yeah, well, duh. So time of day was important. Day was not as important, and I think, again, this speaks to the power of the organizers. In Portland, it's a place, it's a destination, people like to be there, and they really tried hard to organize that conference in a way that you know, the last day, that Thursday, wasn't kind of a non-day and kind of a taper away. They had a post-conference social a lot of people stuck around for, so that might have had that effect. So we really want to analyze different conferences, different AFS conferences, and look at the data to see if the organizers are not doing that, if we do see more of a day effect. Room assignment was intermediate to time of day and day itself, but we did correct for room size in our analysis. So really, the room assignment had to do with where you are in physical space. So, and that translates into how far people had to travel to get to your talk. So there was a cluster of rooms at Portland that were quite far away from all of the other rooms. And so if people wanted to go there, it was quite a hike. And we saw attendance take a hit for that cluster of rooms.
Were there any factors that surprised you when looking at the data that you thought would have more of an impact or possibly less of an impact on how many people were in the room?
Yeah, how far someone traveled to get to the conference was the second most important factor. And when we were doing this, we weren't sure which way it would go. We didn't know if you were far away, that it might be considered like an exotic talk and a lot of people would go, or if you're fairly local, then there'd be a lot of interest in your talk. And it was the latter. So there was this negative relationship. And so the further away, in general, the further you had to travel to get to the conference, the less likely you were. And right around continentally, it wasn't that big of a deal. But if you're coming overseas to come to an AFS, and I probably shouldn't say this, hopefully if AFS is not listening, but attendance was low for people that looked like they were coming from overseas. So coming from Japan, from Asia, from Australia, and from Europe. And we just think that has a little bit to do with being out of network. And maybe out of topic as well. Out of network meaning that a lot of people that know you and the research that you do, and also the topic that you're working on. So there's less interest, potentially. Oh, and whether you were in a symposium also didn't matter. And we thought it might, because symposia are supposed to be, you know, a core of people that they kind of come together on a topic. And so we thought there'd be this baseline amount of attendance at the symposium itself, and we really didn't see that. It probably has to do with the fact that some symposia are just larger and smaller. There's a range there, and it's looked very similar to if you just kind of go solo and give a contributed talk.
And while it wasn't the original goal of the paper, I'm sure some could look at the results and try to throw a few ones or 20s towards the organizers and try to shape their presentation to attract as many people as possible. Yes, what would be some of those big factors to key in on if you were shaping the ideal presentation?
As a presenter right now, if you want to score big at a conference, then you should stay in network. So go to fairly local conferences, or at least on the continent. And again, this is not an absolute truth. This is just on average. You want to have a short title and a long abstract. I'm not really sure why. And this is hard to control, but you want your H index to be a little higher. So an H index is a measure of your seniority/productivity, kind of. Or at least that's how we were sort of using it. So the higher the H index, kind of the bigger your name. We're looking into catchy titles, as I mentioned. We also want to do topic and sentiment analyses. But it's an important caveat that I want to convey is that it's a zero-sum game, if that makes sense. And by that, I mean, if let's say you want to, the advice is to have a short title. If everyone presenting at AFS had a short title, they were all similarly short, then the advantage is gone. And it'll be other things that become important factors.
And if I remember correctly, you were also collecting data at the meeting last year in Atlantic City. Have you or your co-authors been able to look into that data and compare it to the meeting in Portland?
We've made a little progress. We were able to collect the attendance data, and where we're bogged down right now is getting the predictor variables. Like I said, it was a lot of work. So we're actually about to hire an undergrad or a handful of undergrads, and we're going to assign someone to that so that we can get that paper going and start to add in the sentiment analyses, topic analyses, ideas that I mentioned before, take it a little bit further. And we're really interested in doing it over time for multiple conferences so we can start to look for trends and differences in how the organization, how the organizers are setting up the conference and start to see what tends to be quote-unquote good for presenters. So, you know, you really don't want to present right after lunch or really early in the morning. What can an organizer do to offset that dip in attendance? Are there ways we can get people out of bed back from lunch so that they're attending presentations again?
And I'm sure now that we've mentioned it a couple times, people are probably remembering in their distant memories, people running into a room and writing down number, running out. That's all volunteer-based, isn't it? Do you have those people lined up for the meeting in Reno, or are you going to be doing this attendance counting again?
It's not the plan. It's hard to find volunteers, for one. And so when I was out at AFS Atlantic City, I hardly saw any of the conference because I was one of the volunteers. And so it does make for a different conference experience. I think the data are important. I think we need to try to find a way to automate data collection, if at all possible. So, you know, we've got some ideas kicking around about how to do that. Unfortunately, they tend to require money. And I don't know, maybe if people want to email me and give me their ideas, but right now I'm kind of shying away from Reno because it is a joint conference. And I don't know what that's going to do to the dynamics. And so, you know, if it might not matter, but if it's, you know, we're interested in comparing among fisheries presentations. What is a fisheries presentation? A lot of the presentations and symposia are intended to be blended, and I love that idea, but it might be a bit of an outlier, and the results we get might not be generally applicable to AFS meetings because of that joint aspect.
Well, Paul, thank you for filling us all in on some of your past and future projects. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions that I asked each of the guests to come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Oh, man. Esox, Lucius, all the way.
All right. And what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
I have a funny story. I don't know if it's appropriate for a podcast. I don't know if it's appropriate for the internet. All right. The story goes that a young woman from Australia emailed me and my PhD student saying that she was traveling through the country and looking for labs to volunteer in short term. And she sent her CV, but we were doing our due diligence and we Googled her. And it turns out that her name was almost exactly the same as a famous porn star. So I was at home Googling this stuff and a little shocked. And when I got back, I figured out what was going on. But the next day I went up to my PhD student and I asked her, like, did you Google her? And that kind of became that phrase, did you Google her, became a joke for a few years.
Sounds like a pretty comical scenario you're in there. I'm sure you had lots of memorable encounters with students over the years, but what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
I'm living it, Nick. Ball State University in Muncie.
All right. If money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
I have one, but I'm not going to say it because I don't want to get scooped. A funny answer might be something like fish responding to be driven around and Teslas are eating chunks of gold or something. I don't know. I just figure then I have Teslas and gold lying around after.
All right. And then finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Oh, that all of my grants should be funded. No. How about that the word data is a plural noun? I know that language evolves, but I can't abide. It's like listening to someone say something like, all of this cars is causing a traffic jam. It just grates on my brain. So language evolves, but that's kind of a hill that I'm willing to die on, even though I think it's a losing battle. Data are, not data is.
Well, Paul, thank you again for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your projects at Ball State and at the past and hopefully future AFS meetings. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
I'd say email is best. So paventurelli@bsu.edu, and that's all one word. So paventurelli.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter @fisheriespod, on Facebook, facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive the remaining episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 55th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, data is a plural noun.